First off, can you guys hear me in the back of the library?
Yeah.
Okay. And is that too loud? Am I blowing you guys out? I promise not to sing. Actually, I take that back. Let's see how the night goes. You never know.
I might sing.
We should do this as a duet. Do you know any Sonny and Cher? Okay. Okay. So first off, I think I know everybody here, but I'm Jeff Higgins. Welcome to Elaine's. This is my wife, Cynthia, my beautiful wife right over here. Beautiful and brilliant. We've turned this into a literary salon. And can I count myself as an interviewed author? Okay, I think I'm 125, maybe 126. Wow. We've done a lot. So we've made this a home for writers. So if you're a writer, if you know a writer, please let them know. We offer free space to authors. This is your literary home and hub in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area. So we're here to talk about the Havana Syndrome, which is really exciting. And I am honored to have Katie Wynn with me. She's a former editor at Glamour Magazine. Her psychological thriller, You Know What You Did, received the Agatha Award for Best First Mystery. Let's get some applause for that. It was also named the Lefty Award finalist for Best Debut Mystery. It is currently nominated for an Anthony Award in the category of Best First Novel. In their starred review, Booklist described the novel as a twisty, horror-filled thriller and an incredibly compelling debut. You Know What You Did was selected as People Magazine's Best Book of April 2024 and named the Best Mystery and Thriller Book of 2024 by Elle Magazine, yeah. Deadly Pleasures Mystery Magazine, Book Bub, and Parade. That's a pretty good list right there.
I like this crowd.
It's a friendly crowd. When she's not writing, you'll find KT practicing Krav Maga, watching the Mets, boo, Red Sox fan. Or gardening. A graduate of Brown University, KT lives just outside Washington, D.C. with her family and their adopted terrier, Alice. KT is a proud member of Crime Writers of Color, Sisters in Crime, Mystery Writers of America, and International Thriller Writers. So please welcome KT.
And I agreed to do this before I knew about the Red Sox. So.
We could just talk baseball for the whole time. I know some people here would actually enjoy that. There he is.
Well, I am going to introduce Jeffrey James Higgins because of the podcast. Everyone's listening to this around the world. I know a lot of you know him already, but Jeffrey James Higgins is a retired supervisory special agent who writes thrillers, short stories, creative nonfiction, and essays. He has wrestled a suicide bomber, fought the Taliban in combat, and chased terrorists across five continents. Jeffrey received the Attorney General's Award for Exceptional Heroism and the DEA Award of Valor. CNN, Fox News, and the New York Times have interviewed him, and he's appeared on CNN Declassified, National Geographic's Narco Wars, and ABC News. He has a BS in Journalism and an MS in Criminal Justice. He's the number one Amazon bestselling author. He's won the Claymore Award, PenCraft's Best Fiction Book of the Year, and a Reader's Favorite Gold Medal. His last novel, The Forever Game, was selected as one of the best medical thrillers of the 21st century. And today, I'm excited to talk about book one in his new Nathan Burke International Espionage series, The Havana Syndrome.
Well, that's all the time we have left today. Thank you all for coming. Appreciate it. Drive safely and don't forget to tip your servers.
So I just wanted to say this to start off. I listened to the audiobook of this and I listened to it pretty much in one sitting and I really enjoyed it. And I might.
I love the surprise.
Because I don't read a lot of really action-packed international espionage thrillers because they. I haven't found them to be that captivating, but I really enjoyed this. It was really engaging. Like for me, it's subjective, but I really found this to be engaging, and you did a really great job of connecting readers with the emotions of the characters and making them really, really well-rounded. And the story is told from a number of perspectives in addition to the main character, Nathan Burke. How did you manage to juggle all those characters without making it confusing?
I'm still confused. So I did not do it. No, you know, so what I do, and I know some other writers who do this as well, but I'll write one point of view character all the way through. because there has to be an arc, you know, it has to make sense on its own. And it can be really confusing with the 2-3 POV characters. So I'll write one all the way through. Then I'll have to fit them together to keep the tension up and make sure the right things are happening at the right times. You know, so I outline in Scrivener. So I have an idea what it'll look like. But it's a lot of it's just putting the pieces of the puzzle together.
I think some final stragglers are here, so we can
welcome everybody.
Will you give us all your elevator pitch, just the basic idea of what the Havana Syndrome is about?
I would if I could remember it. That would be wonderful. Since you know, I did write this like 4 years ago. So basically, it's Nathan Burke's an FBI agent, and he's chasing terrorists in D.C. But he's longing to reunite with his estranged wife. And then she gets stricken with Havana syndrome in the Dominican Republic. So he decides he wants to try to solve this syndrome, figure out what's been afflicting all these politicians and diplomats around the world as a way to try to win her back, but also to protect her. And so he enlists the help of Mei Li Chan, which is one of his FBI Academy mates, who's working on the Havana syndrome case for the FBI. And he goes around the world, but he has to run a rogue operation because he's not assigned to this. So he's really endangering his career, his personal life. But then as he digs things up, he gets closer and closer to what he believes is the truth. A lot of clues point to the Russians, but the CIA and the FBI are still saying these are anomalous health incidents with psychogenic causes. So the closer he gets to that, the more danger he and the people around him are in. So when people start getting targeted, he starts realizing there's people he can't trust. So that's sort of a back jacket copy-ish.
Well, the Havana Syndrome is a controversial topic. What drew you to write about this in a thriller novel?
Yeah, so I mean, you're right. It's controversial. A lot of people know about it. I read a declassified FBI report in 2020. And I think it was a 2018 report declassified a couple of years later. And they called it anomalous health incidents, right? And they
will you describe it just in case people don't know what it is?
So it's a phenomenon that's afflicted people. I right now over 1,000 people, but officially like 300 something people of US diplomats. And it comes with a spectrum of symptoms like there's tinnitus and disorientation and dizziness and nausea and pain. And it has a lot of the hallmarks of like directed energy weapons or sonic weapons or RF weapons. But it's been afflicting people around the world. So I read this report and they were basically saying psychogenic causes, meaning mass hysteria. But I looked at the people who this was happening to, and I actually know some of the people that this happened to. And they were, you know, CIA officers and federal agents and people who work in these really dangerous, tension-packed, locations. But then when they go back to the embassy, that's like the vacation for them. That's where they go to unwind and relax. So it just didn't make any sense that this was that there wasn't something to this. And, you know, like with anything, when you have 1,000 people, there's probably people who are faking. There's probably people who want to get on disability or whatever. But the vast majority of people, something is happening to them. And I think there was a woman in the National Security Council who was in Arlington who just started having these symptoms and could hear the high-pitched whining and like all the classic symptoms. And she had a seizure. And when she went down, her dog did too. Her dog was having a seizure at the same time. So to me, that kind of refutes the mass hysteria thing. I guess dogs can be empathetic, so maybe not. But I think that kind of refutes it.
And that details in the book too. It's really compelling.
Is it?
It's really interesting. Where does it actually stand now? What is the status of the official government?
The official thing is still anomalous health incidents, but there are different agencies that have slightly different takes, and I would say a lot of people aren't 100% behind that. But they can't find like traumatic brain injury. They can't find evidence, physical evidence of a lot of these problems. But people have had severe problems from it.
Yeah.
They've talked about environmental factors, you know, could it be dust or insects, feces or whatever, right? And they went through all the, should I say insect feces in a restaurant? They suspected the lamb shank for a long time, but that's not it. there's a lot of different theories, but the psychological solution is where most people still fall.
And one thing that I felt added a lot of extra richness to this book that I don't see in other thrillers of this kind, there are a lot of really specific insidery details, just basic things about how different governmental agencies work together, intelligence and law enforcement. Did you need to interview old friends, old colleagues, or is it pretty much the same as when you were there? Did you do research?
You know, I do a little bit, like most of the locations in this book I went to, you know, so I was in Estonia and in Kiev and like in all these different places. So a lot of that I just drew from memory, you know, maybe pull up some Google Earth to remember, see if I remembered things correctly. But the actual, like the trade craft and everything, I mean, that's what I did for, you know, over 20 years. So a lot of that just comes from what I did. But I did interview people who had Havana syndrome. And I did, you know, when there's something very specific, I like to talk to somebody. Sometimes it's hard to get that expert, you know, but I try, given time.
Yeah, you did a really great job. It was fascinating to me, and the level of detail and just the realistic element of how everyone works together.
You know, I made all this up.
I mean, the book is so well plotted. You mentioned outlining and Scrivener. I love Scrivener too, but how detailed was your element? And when you start a new project, how detailed do you create?
Yeah, so I mean, in writing, they say the pantsers and the plotters, people who outline and people who just start writing and see where the characters take them. And I've always been an outliner. And when I first started, I outlined like crazy. Like I had every scene outlined. But what I found is once you're writing and you're in the character's head, things happen and you have to go with it, you know, because you just have to let the story tell itself. And so at some point you feel like you're channeling. So where I used to do everything, now like I outline, there's like 15 major story beats, you know, in any story. So I have those major beats, and don't ask me to list them all now, but you know, it's basically, you know, your inciting incident. There's a midpoint reversal, and there's a darkest night, and there's those types of big moments. So I have that in my head, and then I write, and as scenes come to me, I just fill them in with little couple sentence descriptions, and then sometimes I'll get to them, and I no longer want to write that scene.
Yeah, I think it's important to give yourself permission to stray away from the outline, just to
The outline is something you created in your imagination at the beginning, right? And it doesn't necessarily match what happens later. So what I found is a more sparse skeleton is it still gives you the format. So you still know where you're going. You still know the major beats. But it gives you that room to let the characters grow and those magic moments, right? When the characters make decisions or say things and you don't know where that came from.
And to me, tell me if I'm off base, this book explores the pitfalls of pursuing ideology blindly and being too dogmatic about certain things. In your experience, how much does ideology or belief factor into the behavior of those in governments and positions of power, and how much of it is ambition or greed?
Yeah, it's a great question, right? And so I think it means both. You know, people are human. So even ideologues, like I investigated terrorism for most of my career, you know, so these are ideologically, you know, so theo-ideological driven people. And, you know, so but they're still human, you know, and so they still seek power. They still want to do better. They still want to gain rewards, you know. So it's a mixture of both. But the ideology is interesting, too, because a lot of times it's really the heart of the motivation. But it can be misleading, too. You have to look at individual actors as individuals.
I think that question came to mind, not to put a political spin on it, but just seeing the current administration and wondering, in your book, people behave because of noble beliefs, and they behave because they're inspired by a greater ideology. I think in general, we're seeing less and less of that and more kind of ambition or greed. Do you feel like that's the case or no?
I think it's always been true in politics, to be honest. I mean, in general, politicians are the worst among us, you know, but no matter what side of the aisle you're looking at, there are people who are looking out for, like, I was a commissioner in D.C., so I'm the worst among us, but I would advocate, I'd be in front of, you know, a couple hundred people, and I'd be telling them, you don't want us to have this power. Like, you know, like, it should be like citizens who step up to help, like, us for some collective good that's, you know, and then get out. It shouldn't be like, I'm going to get into this position and then do whatever I can to stay in this position and to get what I can from it. And unfortunately, that's what you get. But ideology in and of itself isn't bad. It depends on the ideology, right? I'm ideological in a lot of ways, and in certain, you know, economic theories and political theories and things that I believe in. And I think there's a lot of data, but I'm always open to change. We've given new evidence. You know, I think it's the blind adherence to ideology and or an adherence to an ideology that's bad. And they're and right. Everything is not relative. Yeah, there is some bad ideology out there.
So The Havana Syndrome is book one of four in the Nathan Burke International Espionage series. How is your brain different for a series versus a standalone? You've done standalones in the past.
Yes, this is my first series, and I wrote it as a standalone, but I made the last line so that it could be a series. And then my publisher said, hey, we can only really sell series. Is this a series? And I said, absolutely. You know, so how many books do you want? You know, so there's a lot of different like challenges when you have a series, because you have to look at arcs for the characters. And, you know, it's like, you know, think of like a Reacher or somebody like that. They can only change so much, right? There's not a lot, because you can't have 50 books and have this massive character arc in every book. So, you know, like in this is an open ended series. I'm writing book four right now, and it's due in August, and there's going to be a rapid release. So book two comes out in September, and then book three in December, and book four in March. So they're coming out fast. But it's doing well so far, and if it does well, they might want more. So it kind of affects the way I write, right? I'm on book four, and I don't know if I should be wrapping this up. I just interviewed a really talented author the other day, and he told me that he has a long-running series, but he has a contract. In his contract, it says if they decide to cancel, like they're done, he gets one more book so he can wrap everything up. And I think that's brilliant, you know, because you don't want to leave people hanging. So, you know, there's many challenges. The easy part is you've already created a universe. So you have a protagonist, you know, you have people around them. There's some knowledge. Like, you want every book to be a standalone so people can, like, enter the series at any place. But so you have to give a little bit, like, just hints as to what happened before without spoiling too much. But the characters themselves, the arcs I found, I mean, there has to be a little something new in each book. But they can't be these massive, like personality changes that you might see in a standalone.
Yeah. I actually didn't know this. I went in reading it completely blind, and I didn't know this was a series until the end. I started to get a sense of it. And now I'm heavily invested in some of the characters. Nathan and his estranged wife. I need to know what happens. So maybe you can tell me before the next book.
Really good stuff. Yeah. You know what I'll do? I'll write it all down for you, and it's available on Amazon.com.
I listened to an interview with you where you said you try to get everything down on paper and writing really, really quickly to get it all there, and then you go in later and edit. Are you ruthless about cutting? How different would the first version of the Havana Syndrome be from the version that we have here?
So the more time I have to edit, the better. And I talk to a lot of authors here, too. And what I always tell them is just get through that first draft as fast as possible, because then you have something you can work with. Right. And no one's going to see it but you. So you can always fix it. But also there's something magical about storytelling. And like, I really feel like I'm channeling stories. Like, I don't know where they're coming from sometimes. And when I'm in it and I'm writing every day, the story lives in my subconscious. I wake up thinking about it. Right. But if I take time off, or and a lot of it's, I'm a little ADD, right? And if I go too long, like, I get bored with something.
Yeah.
So I want to write it in a few months and just get that out. And then the editing, it can change a lot. You know, I do a structural edit. I do copy edits. I do character edits where I follow one character all the way through. I do check the language that the characters are using, make sure there's consistency, make sure they're making the right decisions. I mean, I could just edit for a long, long time, but like right now I'm on a 6-month delivery schedule. So if it takes me 3 or 4 months to write the book, it doesn't give me a lot of time.
No, and I mean, in some cases, that's probably good. They know the hard cutoff point, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I do know writers who screwed up their writing by just going back in too many times. Like, at some point, you like, okay, it's working. You know, don't mess with it too much because there's a rhythm for language.
Yeah,
you can't see it yourself. That's why you need good editors. I've been really fortunate. I'm with this book. This series is with Severn River, and their editors are terrific.
You've written in several different subgenres of crime fiction. You have The Forever Game as a techno thriller, you have a political crime thriller, psychological thriller, and now international espionage. Why did you do this to yourself versus focusing on one subgenre?
I'm trying to make it as difficult as possible for readers to follow me. It's a terrible branding idea. I write what I want to write. You know what I mean? So like I've written the books as they come. Like the last one that came out, The Forever Game, was a techno thriller about artificial intelligence. And honestly, I just want to get that one out because it was coming true. So like I had to get it out fast, you know? So my real passion is psychological suspense, which was my first book. And I have a couple of completed manuscripts that I have to go on submission with. But you hit a really good point because it's a branding issue, right? So people who read this may not want, like, you know, a female in jeopardy in an isolated, like, setting. It's with psychological suspense and more of a slow burn. It's a very different type of book.
But if your cover is very clearly distinguished and delineated what subgenre it is, I think readers are smarter than we give them credit for, and they'll find it. And I think a lot of authors, like Ashley Winston, a lot of them are having success writing in different genres and not under a pen name as themselves. If anything, I think it's like publishers are their gatekeeping. They're trying to keep you in this little narrow category. But if you write well in each of these subgenres, which you do, I mean, The Havana Syndrome got a starred review in Literature. How cool is that?
Yeah, it was fun. I was excited about that.
Yeah.
You know, but you make a good point. And some publishers are guessing, right? And so you hear this from agents, you hear from publishers that they don't, you know, you have to stick in one thing. If you've written this, we just want more of this. But there's some marketing truth to that as well. And it's the marketing and sales departments that really drive a lot of acquisitions in these publishing houses. So they understand that, like for instance, let me give you an example. The first book, I did Facebook ads. And so I could see the audience. It gives you the demographics. It was 80% female. Second, and it was like, I think it was like 40 plus, 80, you know, that was the majority of readers. Second book was crime fiction, 90% male. So, I mean, a completely different audience, right? And so, you know, maybe that's an aberration, but it is harder to bring the people with you, you know, when you do that. But I think you're right. If a good cover, you could, you know, and like, I don't know about you, but I don't want to read the same thing all the time. Like I like all these genres. I like more than thriller too. You know, I do have a comedy coming out. Honey, should I tell them about that? It's called Living with Egyptians. It's fiction.
Yeah, it's really good. Yeah.
I've been working. I've got like 300 pages in notes, and I just have to. I've got the thing. I'm pitching it as my big fat Greek wedding meets 9/11.
And has the wife read this? Has she read your notes?
I have to tell you that this book has absolutely no resemblance to anybody living or dead. It is not nonfiction. My wife does not appear in this book in any way. Did I get that right, honey?
That sounds good.
Yeah, if anyone has a guest room, just see me after. I'll be needing it.
Going to be sleeping here after today. We hear a lot about your background in narco-terrorism over 20 years in the DEA, right? I was surprised to learn you were a writer first and that you kind of you're a newspaper reporter and you kind of fell into law enforcement. So how did that happen?
So I wanted to be a writer since I was like 5 years old. Like I have stories I wrote and, you know, with construction paper and illustrating when I was a little, you know, anthropomorphized animals and things when I was a little kid. So I always wanted to do that. And my parents told me, you can't make a living writing books. Boy, were they right, you know. And so I decided to go into journalism. So my undergraduate degree is in journalism. I became a reporter and I was a news editor. And then I was between jobs and I saw an ad for a private investigator. And I was a big Robert Parker fan. So I was like, oh, this will be great fodder for books. And let me just do this. So I did it. And I got exposed to a whole group of people that I hadn't been exposed to before who wanted to go into law enforcement, like that whole world. And then I had an opportunity to become a cop. And I was like, let me do that. This will be great. Again, thinking, you know, it'll be fun. It's a worthwhile thing, but also for my books. And then that turned into 25 years of law enforcement. So
where were you a policeman?
Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office in Tampa, Florida.
Is that where you're from?
No, I'm from Boston.
How did you end up in Florida?
They had hiring freezes going on in the Northeast, and so I looked around. It's the second or third biggest sheriff's office in the country, and I started in patrol. I got into a shooting in, like, my first week, you know, and then it was a lot of car chases and fighting, and, like, it was an interesting job for sure, and I worked undercover and street crimes and also narcotics and organized crime detective.
Have you written about that since?
You know, little pieces of that have made their way into my fiction. And I did write a short story with a Hillsborough County Sheriff's deputy, the interrogation or something like that. Yeah.
It seems like there would be a lot of interesting characters.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, especially now, it's harder to find fiction that's stranger than reality, right? Literally, things like the Onion and the Babylon Bee can't keep up. You look at headlines and you go, is that satire?
Exactly. When during your career in law enforcement did you ever find yourself, when were you the most scared? What was your scariest moment in a DEA as a deputy sheriff? What was the most frightening moment?
I was scared all the time. So, yeah, anyone who tells you you're not scared when you're fighting for your life or something is lying, right? But it just gives you some, got shot at a few times when I was in undercover. I had a quick story. This is when I was a cop. Like, I was doing undercover, so hotel motel interdiction, and I'd done like an undercover drug deal in this room, and I went into this hotel room, and it was like two guys. They both have turned out wanted for murder and arson and things, and they had these knives spread out over the bed. And the guy came to drop off the drugs, and I did the deal with them, and I was wearing a wire, and I'm like giving a signal, but my guys were taking a while to come. So the guy, the drug dealer was leaving. So I'm like, he's going to get away. So I kicked the door shut. But it was one of these big, you know, it was in a bad neighborhood. It was one of these, like, really thick steel doors. And when I hit it, the bolt slid home. And so it was just me and these three guys in there. So the guy started fighting. So it's on tape.
Did they know why you kicked the door? Did you not?
Like, they figured it out really quick. Yeah, no, I told them.
Good time with you.
I got to tell you, I miss you guys. Why can't we just... So I fought this guy. The other two guys, like, when I told them I was a cop, like, they kept their distance. They were coming in on me, but then they started trying to knock in the door. Like, the police were trying to come in to get me, but it took 3.5 minutes of fighting. And I don't know if you've ever, like, I mean, you fight, right? Krav Maga, and, like, you
this is a very different story.
It's very different, but also that's a long time to fight, right? That's longer than a boxing round, right? It's a long time. So that was pretty scary. I got a little bloody on that one, but it was pretty scary.
Your backup.
They had to come because they had to be in a concealed location, and then they couldn't get through the door. And then the guy I was fighting turned out to be on PCP too, so that was fun. That made him harder to subdue. Yeah.
And you need to do a short story about that.
Yeah, no, I plan on doing a nonfiction thing with some of the incidents, because there's a lot of them. I mean, we could just tell law enforcement stories all day. I was 4 days in Afghanistan, and I wrestled a suicide bomber.
And I do need to find out about that. What is the story? Is that embellished? Is that a real?
No, that's real. I wish that was embellished. No, my partner at the time was, I got there, so I was the assistant country attaché. And he had a source that was into this this Higgs cell, and they killed a bunch of Germans at the airport, and he had a source, and so he was trying to get the international security forces to action when he brought these bomb makers together, and he couldn't do it. I was briefing the drug czar at another agency that day, so I missed it. So the next day, it was myself and my partner. We went out with a source, and we got this quick reaction force. So military it was Canadian-led, but it was an international security force. And we set up this thing with our source, and they're going to meet this bomb maker and the suicide bomber at a tea house. And so we got it all set, and we had a source who was talking to another source who was at the – so it was like this game of telephone, and we had, you know, interpreters and so the whole thing. And we got everyone in place, and our source is like, okay, he's here. And we were like, okay, you're in the tea house. You're in talking. Yes, you know. So we launched the force, and then we went in with the guys, and we hit the tea house, and he wasn't there. And we're like, oh, no, right? Like, and so we're like, what happens? We pulled our guy aside, and he's like, oh, he's still across the river, like miscommunication. This is real world, right? This stuff happens. And so, but we had a giant military convoy and they couldn't turn it around. We were on one side of the river in downtown Kabul. And we're like, this guy has a bomb and he's looking to kill somebody. So my partner and I grabbed the source and a Norwegian a radio operator, and we jumped in a car and we drove down and we saw him. So now we're following one of our sources and the bomber, and he's carrying the bomb in a bag next to him. And so we're vectoring them in with the radio. And then we've got like a helicopter up and we have a big X on our roof, you know, so they're following us. It's all on video. Right. And so we're following the guy and we're saying, you guys got to take him. He's going to do something bad. And he's nervous. He knows there's military activity in the area. And as he's walking, our source, like he just walks away from our source. And now he's by himself. And so we're in the car, and we had it was a Marine anti-terrorism officer, this Norwegian radio operator, myself, my partner, right, and our source. And so we said, hey, we want permission to make this arrest ourselves. And so the Marines get on the thing to their hire, and they ask them, hey, they want permission. And the guy said, absolutely not. You know, like, permission denied. You can't do it. Just wait. And I said, we got to go. And my partner's like, oh, we're going? And I said, do you want to go? And then we just both jumped out of the car. So the two of us, so we said, we chased after this guy, and he turned around. My partner tackled him first, and the bomb went flying up in the air, and it landed next to us, and I landed on top of him. So we're fighting with this guy, and he's trying to get into his pocket, and he had the detonator. So he's trying to detonate while we're fighting him. So we're rolling around down the street fighting this guy, and my partner broke his leg in the fight. So it's a mess. So at one point, we're like, he's like, you got to shoot him. Like, he was underneath him. I was on top of him. So I pulled out my gun and I put it against the guy's head, which is a hard thing to do, right, to kill a human being, right? But as soon as I did that, the crowd that had surrounded us in downtown Kabul went crazy, and they were throwing bottles at us, and they started moving in. So I was pointing my gun at them. And, like, it was a little hairy. Like, this went on for a long time. And then finally, the crowd was coming in, and we were in big trouble, right? So it was just the two of us. And we were on top of this guy, and there were probably, you know, 1,000 people in the crowd. Like, this is all on a helicopter video. And the Apache helicopter came down and hovered right over us, and the rotor wash, like, just kind of blew, like, everybody and cleared it. And then eventually the QRF made it to us, and we arrested him. And then we went back that night into this really bad area outside of Kabul, and we hit the headquarters, the bomb-making facility, with the Norwegians' first real world operation since World War II. Wow. And then for maybe counterterrorism.
So did you get reprimanded or get in trouble, or did you not because it went well and rescued them?
Well, so that's sort of the theme of my books, right? I realize my theme is man versus institution, you know. So it turns out the DEA administrator and headquarters wanted to PNG me out of the persona non grata. They wanted to kick me out of the country for it. And then the military gave us a heroism award. And so they said, oh, and so then we got the Attorney General's Award, the DEA Award after that. But yeah, they were going to try to kick us out of the country.
I'm seeing so many echoes in the Havana syndrome from your story just now, not listening to the radio.
Yeah.
Not to give any spoilers away, but the airport scene in the Havana syndrome is so, like, thrilling and well done. Is that based on?
Tell me more, KT.
But you're right, finishing before. Well, there's a really good airport scene in there. So just so you know, because sometimes when people write action, it's hard to follow. It's not realistic, and you don't feel like you're in the action. It's just something like comic booky and silly. But I found this really compelling. Just as a layperson, a regular reader, no, you know, law enforcement, military background, it was really engaging.
I can't tell you how happy I am to hear that. Right, that's what I'm shooting for. But I feel like I've been in a lot of shootings, and I've been in a lot of, like, violent, deadly encounters. So, like, what I think writers get wrong is they base it off television, yeah, which is wrong, right? And you have to mix, like, the internal monologue, right? You have to, it's all about the emotion. So you got to, what are the emotions people are feeling when they're going through it? And then there's the actual dynamics of a deadly encounter. You know, when things slow down, like the first shooting I was in, I had, like, the tunnel vision, my hearing shut down, like the whole thing, like the whole classic picture. But then the more you do it, like I was in a shooting, like not maybe a couple of years after that. And my heart rate never got above 80, you know, so like at some point it becomes your normal.
Do you miss the adrenaline rush? I mean, these are really exciting stories. Like, do you miss that on a day-to-day basis, or no, not at all?
Yeah, so that's why I married an Egyptian woman.
Sign of danger.
I'm serious about that guest room. Like anything, a couch, you know, a carport.
You mentioned in an interview how you would have to sit down to dinner with someone who murdered 300 people, for example, like a drug czar, and that you arrested and testified against the world's most prolific heroin trafficker. I mean, we imagine in our minds these James Bond-type villains, but are the bad guys that you met with actually really different than the rest of us?
Yes. A lot of times, no, but I mean, they're still people, right? Like, even these horrible people have done horrible things, have families, and they like to do things for fun, and they like to have dinner and drinks. And so they're still human, right? Like, but if you murder a lot of people, there's something wrong with you, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, some of these people are like the guy you mentioned, that drug dealer, he was responsible for 19.7% of the world's heroin, right? And he also supported the Taliban and Al Qaeda and all these different groups. And he had a source, and they were trying to arrest the source, and they were going to boil him in oil. You know, like,
is that a common thing? Or is it? Is
not at Elaine's. We are gluten free, vegan.
Wow, they were going to boil him in oil?
Yeah, I mean, so these are bad people, right? When you're willing to take human life for monetary gain or for whatever, I mean, something's wrong, right?
Like, it's pretty creative, though.
Yeah, that's lovely.
Were you undercover when you were meeting with these people?
The guy who killed 300 people? Yeah, I was undercover with him. So we were having tea and lunch and discussing deals. I did the first undercover in Afghanistan since before the Taliban. And we did the first case for their narcotics tribunal. And I arrested a warlord. And he had a hit team that came and tried to kill our people. And I mean, it was a fun case, you know, but working undercover is different than other types of law enforcement, right? Because you're kind of in that mode all the time, and you have to kind of act and think. You're acting. You have to act and think like it.
Did you wear disguises? You're pretty distinctive looking, I mean.
Like, what would be distinctive about
it? I don't know.
Like, if you had to pick a feature in my nose?
Did you wear disguises?
You know, in Afghanistan, I did. Like, I had, like, a fake beard, and I'd wear a pakol or something over my – yeah, so – because you definitely would stand out. But when I was doing that undercover, no. I mean, you just have to have a cover that matches what you're doing.
And these are some really bad guys, as you said. Are you worried that they still have some vendetta against you, or their children do, or how do you
– I mean, you can find me online. They're welcome to come and try. You know, I think people are out for self-interest at some point, you know, but I mean, you know, I'm not worried about that. You pay attention. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I know people in this country. I know an Iranian activist who had men outside her house with the AK-47s that the government of Iran sent to kill her. You know, like, I mean, it's possible and it happens. She's got to kind of pay attention.
Wow. And speaking of these terrible, evil people, what bugs you most about the publishing industry?
How much time do we have? We've never lived in a better time for publishing. You've got all these different avenues. There's self-publishing, there's hybrid, there's independent presses, there's traditional presses, big and small, big five and independent. You know, so, I mean, really, for the first time in history, somebody for very little money can get their stuff out there. Now, if anybody can read it, because it's hard to, and there's 3 million plus books a year that are coming out, it's hard to break above that. But that's a really nice time. For publishing, I think, like, a lot of the big five, and except for maybe Simon & Schuster, they're starting to take some indie tactics and strategies that a lot of other big five are not doing. But a lot of them are still stuck in 1970. You know, and they just don't get it. Yeah. And so it's really an opportunity, you know, for other independent publishers to break into that market. Like I told you, like Seven Rivers is going to release every 3 months. And that's sort of like a self-published independent strategy from like 10 years ago that was very effective. And I think, you know, consumer behavior changes. So, you know, right now we're competing with Netflix and all the other, right? You're competing with not just the other books, but all entertainment. So, you know, people, if you have a book out, they want the rest of them. If there's a series, they want to be able to binge read it, you know. So you can't wait 2 years.
Thinking, I binge watch, and if I can't watch all of them, I wait till they're sort of, like, they've all been released so I can just watch all of them. So yeah. 4 books in a couple of years. It's going to seem slow in the future.
Yeah, it's 4 books in 10 months, and hopefully it does well and it keeps going. So that would be good. But yeah, no, I think it's frustrating. I mean, there's gatekeepers with agents, but I mean, I know a lot of agents, and they'll tell you they don't know what's going to sell. The publishers are guessing, you know, how the bookstores will shelf things, how long it'll stay there. The bookstores are guessing what their consumers want, you know, so it's a lot of guesswork and it's hard. Like, it's really hard.
Buying on Amazon.
That's right. I mean, 70-80% of all book sales are on Amazon right now, you know, so that's another thing. A lot of the big five are ignoring the world's biggest bookstore. And I understand the complaints, you know, and I hear them from writers and publishers and things too, but it's the world's best bookstore.
And you can't ignore this. So I am going to take this opportunity to thank you for supporting all of the authors, debuts, New York Times bestsellers, having the space open to host people and this literary salon. I remember when you first started it, I had just recently moved here, and it's just so wonderful that you do this, that you host people at no charge, and you host everyone, whether they're a self-published author who's just starting out, or as I said, you have New York Times bestselling authors in here who you interview. And I just want to say thank you. And also, I wanted to ask you, what is there some kind of overarching lesson or tidbit that you've gleaned from these 124 interviews, not including yourself, that you've done?
Yeah. So first off, thank you for that. Like, it's really my passion to be able to help other authors. And Cynthia made all this possible. Like, she's fellow at think tanks. She's an author. She's a poet. She's just a brilliant, brilliant person. But she made all this, right? This place had hadn't had anything done to it for 38 years because it had been Bilbo Baggins, a Hobbit themed dive bar. But it was fun. And we get a lot of their customers and employees and things. But Cynthia came in here and designed everything herself. She was our general contractor. She literally created this stuff by herself. So it's all her. And then as far as there's a lot of commonality, like when you talk to people who are successful, right? And so there's lots of things. But the biggest one is, probably writing habit, writing not every day, but almost every day, right? And just getting the words on paper and finishing what you start instead of getting distracted by something else. And then, I mean, there's so much, right? There's so much, but everyone is like really successful, and there's a lot of luck in it too, right? Like, what hits the zeitgeist at the right time and the right publisher and everything. But it all has to be great writing. Like, you're writing spectacular, right? So it's, you have to start with that. And then, you know, it's understanding that it has to be edited, right? Yeah. Getting beta readers, having critique groups, you know, understanding the business of publishing and being patient and being able to try to find the best avenue, whatever it is, to get your book out. But in the end, it literally, and I talk to 3-4 writers a week in here who haven't written yet, who come in and ask for advice, and they all have kind of this, or not all of them, a lot of them have the same story. I'm going to write when, or I'll do this after this, or I just can't, there's always an excuse. And, you know, I work sometimes 19 hours a day in here. Last week, I had 2 19-hour days in here, you know? And so if I can find time to write a book every 6 months, they definitely can, right? You can do it. You could do 20 minutes a day and get a book out in a year, you know? And so you really just have to do that. You have to write every day and find that practice, whether it's first thing in the morning when you're in that creative kind of dream state, or late at night, or on lunch hour. I wrote book 2 in the series, 15 minutes at a time, dictating, walking back and forth to this restaurant.
Wow.
Yeah, it was brutal. I don't recommend that.
It must have really good dialogue. I don't people dictate their dialogue. It always comes
I am such a fan. So this last book, book 4 that I'm editing right now, I dictated the entire novel as an experiment.
Oh, you did.
So much so that a few days when I'm tired in the morning and I'm having that first coffee, I sit down and I start writing. I go, nuts, and I delete it and then dictate it. Like, every word in that novel was dictated.
Just to try.
As an experiment. And I got to tell you, I'd been doing it as a tool, but about 40,000 words in, I wanted to quit. Because I was having issues with a bunch of things, and I stuck with it. And at 47,000 something, it finally clicked, and I got the right software. I got the right habit. I got the right behavior. I got it all worked. And now I'm writing like crazy. Like, now I'm more prolific now than I've ever been.
That's scary. You know, Alex Finley, the best-selling author.
Yeah, he was here a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
his looks too, and his wife is terrified that he's going to walk into traffic.
He doesn't dictate. He actually types up with his thumbs and his phone.
While
writing best-selling novels on his phone, the whole novel. It sounds like Gitmo torture.
So we're going to take questions, right?
Like, yeah, I'd love that.
Questions?
Yeah. Just keep in mind, I'm a fiction writer, so I'm a professional liar.
You mentioned about artificial intelligence. You've written about it. We all know the problems with AI. Is there anything in your experience you found useful?
Yeah, so AI brings up a lot of ethical questions, right, for writers, and I couldn't be more against using it to create. I think that's got to come from that special place. It's bad right now, but it'll get good. It'll be pretty indistinguishable. Like, it can do some decent poetry right now, but it doesn't have the soul in it, right? So I really am against using it. And I know a lot of writers who will bounce ideas off of it, do that kind of thing. I guess that's a gray area, you know, but for me, the way I use it for research. So I use perplexity.ai, right? Perplexity Pro, it's like $12 a month or something, and it'll give you all the source material. So like you plug it, you can, and now I'm dictating, of course, right? So I'll just ask it a question, and it'll throw like 12 or 15 or whatever like sources, and then it'll collate it and check for other things, and it'll show you what it's doing. Like they show their work, you know. So it goes down, and then it gives you the answers, and then underneath it has suggested questions. So you can just follow up, and unlike like Googling something, right? You don't have to say everything again. You can just say, okay, but what about in Michigan, right? And it'll just continue with what it did. I find this is such a time saver. I can't even tell you. Like, to me, that's fantastic. And I think you're going to see for marketing, and I think we're all going to, whether you like it or not, we're all going to have like an AI assistant very soon, right? And so all that kind of mundane stuff that you don't want to do, I think that'll be there. I think so. I think it can help you, free you up for the creative stuff. I get irked when writers are using it for the creative stuff, because first off, it's just bad now. But even if it was good, I think it's wrong.
I mean, I write because I enjoy it.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, you know what? If a writer, there's that famous line, maybe you remember who said this, but they said, don't enjoy writing, I enjoy having written.
Yeah, true.
And we all enjoy that, right, the things written. But if you don't enjoy telling the story, you're in the wrong business, because it's hard, right? Yeah. It takes a long time, and it's a lot of work, and it's like buying lottery tickets. It may or may not make you some money.
Does anyone else have any more questions? Great. I'm on my way over.
So, Jeff, you said that you wanted to write since you were 5 years old. So during your very exciting career, was it always a long-term goal that you're going to quit this and write about it or write novels?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So, yeah, I've always wanted to write. I just, when I go overseas, I'd work, you know, months at a time without a day off. I'd work around the clock. You know, I'd go to bed at midnight and be up at 4 a.m. And during that time, I get a call like, oh, there's one of my sources will call and say there's an ambush getting ready to kill some French Special Forces soldiers, right? And so I'd jump out of bed. We'd get the warning out. So it was like you'd sleep 2, 3, 4 hours a night for months at a time. So like writing during that's almost impossible, you know, and even taking notes and things is really difficult because you're doing these really intense like federal cases. We were trying to extradite people, bring them back here, right? So we go after high-value targets and build judicial cases against them. So, yeah, it was always the plan. It's just, I mean, literally, I thought I was going to do it for a couple of years. And then, you know, the deputy sheriff position turned into a federal agent position. And then I just, every few years, what really did it for me was 9/11. I was one of the first three people to get to the North Tower after it came down. And I just stood there in that rubble and I said, you know what, from now on, I'm just going after terrorism. And so that really was, you talk about like ideology, that really guided me, you know, to be like, this is what I want to do. And I'm going to use whatever talents I have here to go after the worst people I can find. And so that, you know, that was a driven thing. That's why I didn't sleep, right? Because if you're going to sleep, somebody dies, like literally, right? Like it's literally life and death stuff. So, yeah, that kept me going. But I retired in 2017, and it was really time. Like I just, you know, my big unit I was with, I think they lost 7% of the people in the unit, you know, and we just, you can only do that for so long. You know, I did it for many, many years. So it was time. And I'm, like you say, I'm so excited to write. Like, it's my happy place. Like, I literally, when I, especially dictating, so much easier to get in the zone, by the way. But I, when I do that, I just transport myself someplace else. I'm in that story completely, you know, and it's really a gift, and it's something I'm so thankful for.
I mean, do you have any residual, you must have some residual trauma or PTSD from this?
What do you
Is your writing a way to work through it?
I don't think so. I don't have anything, yeah.
You seem so well adjusted.
Oh, I don't get that much. Thank you, Katie.
No. One more question? Does anyone have a question? Okay. And then I think Jeff will be signing copies of the Havana Syndrome after this.
Hey, Jeff. I'm a huge fan, as you know. If I finished the book, I read it in the weekend.
Could not
get it down. About the Havana Syndrome rose to the surface and asked you to call attention, to pay attention to it. Because there's so many issues, as you know.
Yeah, it's a great question. So, what about that issue of Havana syndrome made me want to write about it? And I think this is good for all authors. I know a lot of people who do this. As a storyteller, every time I read the paper, every time I hear something, I'm thinking, "What if?" Right? So it's always like you hear something kind of weird, and it's like, "Well, what else could that be?" And when I saw this report on Havana syndrome, it was very clearly not true, in my opinion. Right? And so then I started thinking, well, if it's so obviously not exactly as they're saying, and it might be partially correct, right? But if it's not as they're saying, what's the motivation and what's really going on here? And so that's what got me excited. But I do that all the time. There's a 1440, I think it's like a news aggregator, and they have like a section about like weird stories every day. And I love reading that because, I mean, every day I'm writing down like story ideas or snippets that they can go into a book at some point. So I think that as a writer, saying what if it is hugely beneficial.
Thank you so much for inviting me to interview you. And thank you so much to everyone for coming out tonight.
Thank you, KP. Nice round of applause for KP. That was really nice. Thank you.